Hello everybody, welcome to this podcast. I am Büşra Yalçınöz Uçan, a postdoctoral research fellow at the Department of Media and Social Sciences, University of Stavanger in Norway, and this podcast is part of my two-year postdoctoral study, which is funded by a Mercury Individual Fellowship Program. This is the second episode of a two-part podcast where I present and discuss some of my research findings. My research focuses on the relationship between gender-based violence and digital technologies and offers a situated and survivor-centered understanding of this relationship. In the first episode, I discussed some of the challenges and barriers that women survivors of gender-based violence encounter while accessing and using digital technologies. I defined and talked about concepts like digital coercive control or social digital inequalities and discussed how gender-based violence, specifically digital coercive control, hinders women's inclusion in digital spaces, and how their exclusion from digital spaces becomes a significant determinant of their experiences of social inequalities and marginalization. In this second episode, I will share some other insights from my research with regard to the positive uses of digital technologies in women's lives. The question for today is how digital technologies can and do facilitate women's processes of surviving violence and seeking safety. So today, I am asking what are the ways women use technologies for achieving safety, nonviolence, and self-determination. I want to start with a story. This is a story of a young woman in her 20s. She was one of the women I interviewed in 2016 for my PhD study, which was about women's daily decision-making processes in violent relationships and their help-seeking experiences. This story is one of the most important inspirations for me to focus on digital technologies in my current project. So this woman, I will call her Esra. Esra lives in a small city near Turkey's southeast border. She is subject to her partner's severe physical violence. She doesn't have any family in the city where she lives. Her whole family is living in another city in Turkey. She doesn't have opportunities to go out alone, as her husband is very strict in this sense. He doesn't want her to leave the house. Yet, she has a smartphone. There's a computer at home, and she has access to the internet. She has a 2-year-old daughter. She likes to read things about motherhood. She follows several mothering blogs, a few Facebook groups. She watches YouTube videos. Somehow, luckily maybe, her husband doesn't check what she does on the internet, or he doesn't become suspicious about it. So digital coercive control or digital monitoring is not part of the violence she is subjected to. After a period during which the intensity and frequency of physical violence she is subjected to increase, she decides to write about her experiences. This is, however, not articulated as a decision, but defined more like an urgent need to do something, to take some action. There is a well-known, popular blog she follows, and it involves a chat box where people can communicate anonymously. She writes about her experiences and asks for support and advice. This act of online disclosure and help-seeking creates an online community around her. The users of this blog, who are mostly women, get mobilized to support her, not only emotionally, but also in very practical, tangible ways. People help her connect with the available services in the region. After several months, through the support of this online community, Esra becomes able to escape her violent husband. This is a very inspiring story in terms of clearly showing what digital spaces can offer to women. And this story becomes an inspiration for my current Mercury project. My project has started nearly 6 years after I collected this story, and in between, two important things happened: the Me Too movement and COVID-19 pandemic. Through both of these, we have witnessed how the internet and social media can become alternative platforms for people to seek connection, support, and justice. Since then, we increasingly witness how technologies are being used in creative and transformative ways by many women survivors of gender-based violence around the world to speak out, to raise their voices. We see how online platforms can be used to raise awareness regarding gender-based violence, to increase its visibility in public, and to challenge misconceptions about it. So my project emerged in this context of COVID-19 and post-Me Too. I wanted to understand how digital technologies can be beneficial for women's safety and well-being needs in violent relationships. In other words, I wanted to explore women's lived experiences regarding the beneficial use of technologies in contracting harm, violence, and isolation, and seeking information, connection, and support. In the first episode, I extensively discussed the barriers and challenges that hinder women's meaningful and beneficial engagement with technologies. The main finding of my study was that the positive role of technologies remains very marginal in women's stories of seeking safety and support, mainly due to digital coercive control dynamics as well as digital inequalities. So none of the women I interviewed shared stories similar to Esra's story. In Esra's story, she has access to a computer, a phone, and the internet. Her access was not monitored or controlled by her husband, so she wasn't subjected to technology-facilitated violence, and she was a digitally competent person. Yet, in contrast to Esra's case, accessing to technological devices or the internet was way more challenging for the women I interviewed for this study. They were all subjected to digital violence, and most of them had limited digital competence. Under these conditions, it's not surprising to see that technologies played a limited role in their stories of escape, safety, and well-being. However, despite the challenges and barriers encountered and digital harm experienced, the stories also addressed that, at times, women were also able to use technologies for their own benefit, mainly to access information and reduce their isolation. Also, the practitioners shared certain observations and insights regarding how the use of technologies is becoming increasingly central in their line of work, and how they use technologies for outreach and providing support to their individual clients, and how sometimes their services become more accessible through online tools and strategies. A major finding is that once women left their violent partners, once they were out of the violent relationships, the positive role of technologies in their lives increases, which means that digital technologies start to play a crucial role in women's post-separation adjustment, safety, and well-being, indicating a transition from limited or no digital engagement to a relatively active use of technologies. Indeed, this transition from disengagement to engagement, despite its ambiguities, seems to result in an improved sense of safety, agency, and self-determination in women's lives. As I emphasized in the first episode, in Norway, having digital knowledge and experience is central as many systems are online. So to function properly in everyday life, to navigate everyday life, one must know how to navigate digital world. This was what was lacking in women's lives. They were excluded from these spaces, and this exclusion in itself becomes a huge factor reinforcing women's sense of alienation from everyday life. Parveen, one of the participants in my study, was totally prevented from using any kind of technologies during her violent marriage, which continued nearly for 6 years. She didn't have a phone, they didn't have a TV in their house, they didn't have a computer or a tablet. She didn't have any means of communication with the outside world. Technologies were not part of her life during those years. However, once she escapes, during her stay in the shelter, she enters into the online world through the support she receives from the shelter staff. Using digital technologies emerges as a necessity as she tries to build her life with her children independently in Norway. She has to engage, and this engagement, learning how to do things online, results in a sense of confidence. She says, in her words, "To do things like filling an online form for my kids or myself, I got help from the practitioners here. When I had to pay the bills, I got some help from them. And now I can do that myself, like how to create an account, etc. Now I feel that I am confident. Every day, I wake up, and the first thing I do is to check my digital calendar. I also check if there are any messages from my kids' school. I also spend some time to find useful educational videos for myself and for my kids. So this transition from no use to being active sounds incredibly empowering. Most women had to start from scratch in learning very basic technological skills, such as how to create a password, how to locate things on a website, or log in certain digital platforms. So starting to feel confident enough to complete such tasks without depending on others seems to be central for women's sense of empowerment, self-sufficiency, and well-being. Another woman, Maryam, similar to Parveen's story, she had very limited access to technologies while she was living with her violent husband. She says, in her words, "I didn't know things like how to buy transportation tickets online, how to use online banking, how to get online appointments with the doctors. I am the only person responsible for my daughter, and now I can do these things myself. I learned all these things to be independent." This sense of independence, being in control of the things in their lives, is central for women survivors of gender-based violence, because the violence they were subjected to destroys their sense of control and agency. Violent partners almost always target women's agency. They use strategies to diminish women's sense of control and autonomy. In fact, digital coercive control is one of these strategies. So being out of digital coercive control dynamics and achieving a free and autonomous engagement with digital technologies seems hugely contributing to women's sense of self-sufficiency and well-being. Women's stories mostly reveal their ambiguity or ambivalence towards online information seeking. This doesn't mean that they don't search information online. They search many things on the internet, from cooking recipes to online Norwegian learning resources. Yet, when it comes to online information seeking concerning domestic violence, as I discussed in the first episode, most women articulated their doubts regarding its usefulness. They highlighted how it was difficult to pinpoint the correct and relevant information. They emphasized their need to speak to a person to find answers to their questions rather than turning to the internet. However, not while they were in violent relationships, but after they left their violent partners, not all, but some women shared that online information and support seeking related to the issues of domestic violence became part of their lives. Nora, for example, who was a Norwegian woman who went through a complicated court process, shared with me that she consistently used the internet during this period to obtain the knowledge she lacked and needed to take informed decisions. She says, in her words, "I have spent a lot of time searching online about the rules and laws. The system is not that much connected. The crisis center, the court, police. One part of the system often doesn't know about the other part. So you can search that information yourself. If there is anything I need to know before doing anything, I just search it. You can also kind of see what the source is so that you can decide if the information is legitimate or not." So we can see here in Nora's words how she used online resources to understand the system, locate the gaps in the system. She used this knowledge as a roadmap to create strategies for her safety and well-being. Regarding social media use, previous research addressed that social media platforms can be potentially empowering spaces for gender-based violence survivors, as these platforms can help survivors feel supported, connected, acknowledged, validated, and less isolated. However, most women in my study told me that it was challenging for them to trust social media. Most didn't see social media sites as useful resources for their well-being. Most importantly, they highlighted their perceptions of risks associated with social media use, particularly in terms of protecting their privacy and confidentiality, especially if they were to create and share content. So most women said that social media didn't have a place in their lives. Still, some of them articulated that they follow social media. They follow, for example, Facebook groups like for migrant women or women survivors of violence. But they highlighted that they are passive users. They follow, they read posts, but they don't comment or share anything. And this emerged as a strategy to protect themselves from harm. Only a few women highlighted that they actively use social media to connect with others or to seek emotional support. One of them, Ella, talked about her experiences of being part of an online support group for domestic violence. She emphasized how this became a crucial part of her life once after she left her violent partner and helped her feel less alone and understood. I'm quoting her. To be able to read stories and what people experience when it comes to the custody of children, financial issues after separation, etc., you see that the stories repeat themselves. You see how similar they are to your story. It makes me feel a little bit good because I feel that I am not that alone with my story. Ella also talked about how her use of social media has changed during the course of her separation, from being very private to posting parts of her life publicly. She underlined that this was important to her because she wanted to show the world that she is okay, she is thriving, she is enjoying her life despite the challenges of the past. So her social media posts became part of her resistance and resilience. She says, I'm quoting her again, it has changed a lot regarding me being very private on Facebook. For a while, I was connected with only the ones closest to me. Now I post a lot publicly. I want to show that nobody is going to steal the person I am. And I am not afraid anymore. This is why it is so important to me to post these photos of myself, my dog, my walks out in nature. I do fun things and they have not been able to break me. It is kind of like a channel of proof for me that I am not afraid anymore. When it comes to the practitioners, similar to the women, they also mostly highlighted their experiences and observations regarding the barriers and challenges to the positive use of technologies. But they also shared that for at least some of their clients, under certain circumstances, online technologies increased public visibility of their services. And they emphasized that this increased visibility may become a factor reducing help-seeking barriers for survivors. A shelter practitioner, Olivia, says, in her words, I think finding us through the website is easier. People do it much faster in these days. So maybe some people seek help earlier than before. The practitioners also underscored that, particularly for younger individuals, using digital strategies has become increasingly essential, either to reach out to them or to increase their engagement with the work they are doing. Maya, a clinical psychologist, says, if I quote her, like reading online information or saying that, just check it out, what is there? This mostly works for my younger clients. It increases their engagement with us. So, suggesting their clients certain online resources, for example, telling them there is this Facebook page here, there is this website or YouTube channel there, this was shared as a common practice, especially while working with younger clients. However, I want to underline that, as I discussed in the first episode, the practitioners were also cautious about completely relying on online strategies, particularly for outreach, as it is their primary observation that for most of their clients, particularly if they come from socioeconomically disadvantaged settings, online resources are not accessible enough. Now, we are at the end of this podcast episode. I started with Esra's inspiring story from my PhD research and continued with the stories of women who participated in my current Mercury postdoctoral study. I discussed how women's digital inclusion and participation needs become central to their post-separation adjustment safety and well-being, as well as how their free and autonomous engagement with digital technologies becomes crucial for them to feel independent and in control of their lives. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and thank you for listening.